Yes, there we go. It's nice when the microphone works. Thursday morning, New York City, having a good old time. Well, you know, I'm a little out of it today. I'm hungover. Well, you know, it's a hangover I don't know if I've ever had before. It's a chocolate hangover. And it's an unusual hangover. I guess it's better than the optional one that I used to typically live with. 5, 6 days. Any day that kind of ended in Y from my previous life, you know. But this morning, yeah, a little hungover. Maybe that's why when I'm walking down the escalator this morning, I literally tripped on the escalator and fell into this guy in front of me. And he looked back at me like he was going to, like, end me. And I'm like, I felt like saying, buddy, first of all, I apologize profusely. And secondly, you know, what are you going to do? It's New York City. I'm on a moving escalator. I didn't have my third cup of tea yet. He doesn't know that. But it was pretty funny. I'm saying to myself, what the heck is going on here? That is crazy. Got a great show coming your way. There's a music academy that I stumbled upon about 6 months ago in the music mecca town of Asbury Park, New Jersey. Incredible town. Historic. If you are in the tri-state area, in the New York tri-state area, you know of it. If you're on the East Coast, you know of it. If you're on the West Coast, if you're listening in Holland, you probably know of the legendary Stone Pony. John Liedersdorf is the owner of this incredible facility, Lake House Music Academy. We're going to meet him in just a few minutes. But I want to talk to you about my music hangover, with chocolate hangover, and all these other hangovers I have. So anyway, I had some time on my hands yesterday. I was working from home about half the day. So I said, you know, let me do something really kind of cool with the kids. I'm going to get some strawberries. You know where this is going. I went to a local chocolatery. What would you say? Chocolatery? I don't know. Place that makes chocolate homemade. Really good. Mammoth Candy. So I buy some chocolate, nuke it. And guess what I did? Man, I blew a lot of people away yesterday. Incredible. I made fresh chocolate-covered strawberries for the bus drivers. So when my kids were getting off the bus, I had the pleasure of getting them off the bus yesterday. I said, hey, turn it back around. Go back on the bus and say, hey, I just made these in the last 20 seconds, like when you got off the bus to the kids. So it was a lot of fun. So not that Valentine's Day is a big day in my house, by all means. But when you have kids, it's kind of a nice way to, in another capacity, show love and how love can be demonstrated. And anytime, any other way I can get to hug and fool around my kids and have fun with them. And, you know, and it doesn't have to be for, I'm all about, you know, like, you see all these signs, men, you know, how can you forget February 14th? Men. But, you know, it's especially in the Me Too movement, why can't it be just about, hey, Valentine's Day is coming up? So anyway, I think the chocolate hangover came from the fact that I was making a lot of these and dipping one in there and putting it on the plate and then taking another one. And yeah, well, that's kind of what happened there. So I didn't think you can actually get hangovers from chocolate. But, you know, hey, that's the reality. That's where I stand today. So pretty cool. I was reading about something the other day. This was announced on Wednesday. And this is really going to change, I think, the landscape of chocolate. No, not chocolate, of concussions. So we've all been obviously very much ensconced in reading about the NFL, CTE, concussions. Matter of fact, I think one of the Patriots, Gronkowski, I always screw up his name because there's two of the guys on the team that sound kind of like, had a concussion, I think, the game or two before, a slight concussion, mild concussion. Who knows? Because they want the guy to play, right? But anyway, there's a new blood test out that FDA approved recently that's going to be able to determine if one has a concussion. Now, I think this is just incredible because, first of all, I think the exposure to radiation is just 99% of the cases I was reading don't need to be, whether you're a child, adult, to be exposed to a CT scan. So 99% of the cases, you don't need this. So this blood test is going to alleviate all of that, take it out of the mix. But who's not going to like this? The hospitals, the clinicians that send them patients to their private labs that do the CT scans. So this is a major, major move that I'm really, really happy that it's coming across. But I'm just very surprised that the FDA, you know, sometimes the FDA like a lot of different government agencies, move really, really slow. And they moved on this very quickly. I'd say within 8 months, less than 8 months. And that's gigantic. So, you know, of course, CT scans will still be necessary for, you know, really traumatic, like I think they call them TBI, traumatic brain injuries. But for the most part, they won't need it. For example, like my son had a concussion 2 years ago, actually. So that would have made him six. So you don't want to put your son or daughter unnecessarily through it. First of all, it's a little bit daunting going through that process, going in that room, the machine, because you can't be that close with them, lead vests, etc. And you don't want to expose anyone, especially a child, unnecessarily to radiation. So I think the battery of tests, of course, that they do in the beginning, which they do for balance, eye movement, vomiting, all that stuff, that's great. But now the blood test can seal the deal. It's very, very conclusive. And I'm just really happy to see that there's more out there. And now I imagine insurance companies are going to be doing the jig because a CT scan, I can't even take a stab at this. I don't remember looking at my bill. I'd say $800, $1,000, $1,500 for a CT scan. It's got to be up there. Of course, if you have insurance, your emergency room is probably $50 copay. Not terrible. I think mine's gone up to $75. But if you don't have insurance, you know, this is great. The blood tests can be very conclusive. So I think that's very, very interesting to have this out, especially in the environment, the landscape that we live in with NFL and high school and college teams really being alarmed necessarily about all the head trauma that's happening. And this is the only thing I could not find, which I was kind of scratching my head about, speaking of heads, is that they didn't tell me or state in this article how soon this test is. It almost like a pinprick for a diabetic. It did not say. I'm like, how can it not say in this two articles that I read about this, about how, yes, it's conclusive. That's great. I'm glad you're waving your flag. But how quickly can it be determined? Can you go to ER and boop, get a blood test? Or does it have to go to a lab and you have to wait 24 hours? Or is it done in 5 minutes? It has to go in a solution. Who knows? I'm not sure about that. But I think that's very, very cool. And speaking of cool things, so, you know, Olympics are upon us. And I know a lot of people are like, well, you know, it's every 2 years. The Winter Olympics aren't that much fun. Curling's not really a sport. I know. But you know what? You got to embrace things, man. You know, it's just, it's kind of fun. It's different. How many times can you watch Friends reruns or the shows on Netflix? But it's a great way to certainly to have camaraderie in a family. But to watch someone like Chloe Kim, 17-year-old, just do her thing. And the fact that they've dedicated herself and her family so much time, that's what I just find just not miraculous, but very impressive, that it can bring a family so close together for so many years. And of course, there's an expense, the time, you don't get that back. You're hoping that it gets you to a certain distance in life, hopefully the Olympics. And if you get to the Olympics, can you actually make it past the trials? You make it into the Olympics. Great. How's your performance? Is it stellar? Can you make it? Can you podium? There's so many barometers and variables involved that's just kind of mind-blowing. So when you see somebody, and anybody, but I'm just pointing out Chloe Kim today because she's so astute. She's so well-spoken. She seems like the kid next door. And that's what you kind of root for, right? The kid who's worked for something in her life. They've had a goal and they've earned it. And then you have Shaun White. Same thing. He's like the grandfather of snowboarding right now. I think they used to call him what, the red tomato or the flying tomato, without his mane of hair right now. And I'm really happy about him because I've always kind of thought he was interesting. And I always thought, and I didn't read a great deal about him in the past, but I always thought he was probably a little bit of a, I don't know, outcast, because a lot of the snowboarders, you know, are partiers, and that what goes with the reputation, a lot of skiers, snowboarders, et cetera. And that's fine. That's cool. I like it. But the fact that he's been in so many Olympics, medaled so many times, and then he didn't. In 2014, he walked away with nothing. And then he had a bad accident. I think that was in Norway, where he had, I don't know how many stitches, 50 stitches, when he fell airborne on the side of the pike. I mean, bashed his head open. Had to deal with a lot of, I guess, light PTSD. But when you're a professional athlete, all those things come into question, especially when you're older. I mean, the average age of these snowboarders are, what, 19, 20, 21? And he's coming in at 31? You know, so the fact that he can come in there and have, out of three performances, three runs, one really good one, one where he fell, and one where he just blew it out of the water. I mean, just incredible. And the fact that, kind of a sidebar, that he is the 100th, well, that is the 100th medal, gold medal, to be earned for the United States in the Winter Olympics. And it happens to be awarded to Shaun White, which is cool. Now, you know where I'm going next, right? Yeah, accusations. Well, it's just kind of a shame, and I got to mark my words and choose my words carefully, because it's not a shame if it's obviously there's guilt involved. But this is the era that we lived in, the live in now, the era of awareness, the Me Too era. And I'm all for this, because no one should have to suffer. No one should have to live in fear. No one should be violated, etc. And so here he is. The gold medal still probably in his palm. His hands probably even haven't stopped sweating. His heart rate probably hasn't even come down. And he's pummeled with questions about sexual allegations, understandably. And so this happened. And apparently it's settled in court or out of court. I'm not exactly sure. But the thing is, it's just so amazing how nowadays, I don't know how somebody could think about, well, okay, I'm an Olympian. I'm a well and highly regarded Olympian. How is this not going to come out? It's public domain information. It's been publicized. He had a ban for years, and this was the drummer. And the drummer filed charges. And it's settled. And I don't know why he was taken so off guard when this was brought up by, I forget the member of the press who he represented. I don't think it was the New York Times, but another highly regarded Washington Post, somebody from there asked him about it. And he was totally taken off guard. And but the point is that, you know, it's unfortunate that, number one, it happened. And then number two, you know, you work all your life to get to a certain esteemed level and you tarnished it yourself. You know, this woman didn't do it. No, you did it. And it's unfortunate that, you know, when you're standing on the podium for the world to see, and then, you know, a couple hours later, the world knows about your dirty laundry. You know, it just goes to show you, when I speak to kids, especially, I have a new talk called Senior Send-Off that a lot of schools are hiring me for, about accountability, responsibility, whether you're going into the first job, military, college, two-year, four-year, trade school, about what you put out there is your image, your reputation, and it will come out to you. There's two major companies in the world. I don't know the names of them off the top of my head. That all they do is archive information on the web. That's it. So if I post a picture right now of me drinking from my water bottle, it lives on for I don't know how long. Well past my time. And that's all they do. I mean, they probably have, you know, remember the computer rooms that when they first came out? What were they called? What were those big computers called? I forget what they were called. Anyway, they probably look like that because they hold millions and millions and kajillions of storage. And that's all they do is back up everything that's on the web for the most part. So what I'm saying is that, you know, the information's out there. So people have to be really responsive and understand that, you know, what you do is out there, and it's for everyone to read, to understand, and to judge you by. So very quickly, I want to talk to you about mental health and Selena Gomez. I want to applaud from the How Cool Is This file, Selena Gomez, because, you know, not only is she a tremendous singer, and apparently she's an actress. I don't know if I did see her in one movie. Yeah, Spring Breakers. Not too much acting going on there, just a lot of bikini wearing. And I wasn't appalled by it. You know, it was okay. For kind of a late night movie watch, it was pretty cool. But I really applaud her because, you know, she was diagnosed with lupus a couple years ago. And when you have lupus, it can expedite or compound if you have a predisposition to depression, anxiety, panic attacks, and more mental health issues. So she's been very vocal, and I applaud people. As you know, if you listen to the show, Insight, on a regular basis or even semi-regular basis, you know that I'm all about putting it out there for people to learn to destigmatize a lot of different areas of the of our lives and of the world we live in. And mental health is a big one that I believe that needs to be destigmatized and has been. In the last 10 years, I think we made really big strides. Anyway, so she came out again. I think it was last year she was saying she kind of needed a break, but she's been so busy that I bet you, you know, if you're going through some issues, you know the management's going like, well, you know, Selena, we got a deadline in 6 months and all these different things are happening. But the fact that she has said, listen, I can't be myself, you know, and that's what I tell people. You can't be yourself when you're not yourself. You can't focus. How can you write music? How can you perform if you are depressed? And, you know, think about all the people who have come forward, even Bruce Springsteen in his book, that I think his depression is more compounded and heavier and darker when he's off the stage, when he's not touring. And I think when he does a stint like on Broadway, like he's doing right now, that, of course, ask any entertainer, whether you're a musician, dancer, poet laureate on stage reciting poetry, that's what fuels you. That's what you do. That's what makes you get up in the morning, put your foot on the floor, or the pen to the page, or your hands on the drumsticks, whatever it is. That's what you thrive for. So it's very, very hard. You know, I understand that she has to take time off, and that's great. I just love that. And the fact that she is astute enough to realize that, you know what? I got to take a break. And that's great. And so lastly, before we meet John Liedersdorf, the owner of Lake House Music Academy in Asbury Park, I want to talk to you about Sports Illustrated very, very quickly. You know the swimsuit issue every year that you either run toward or run away from, depending on, I guess, what your take is. And it's the most successful selling magazine every February. I think it's actually the March issue, but it comes out in February. I don't know why. I can never figure that out. But it features the first Paralympian athlete. Paralympian athletes are the athletes that follow the games, the Olympics, called the Paralympics. And Paralympians are incredible people. I know probably about 20 or 30 of them. Current ones, I only know about two or three. But past ones I've interviewed, just really resilient, hearty, fun, dedicated people who just like will let nothing stop them in life. So here is Brenna Huckabee. She is out west, I think, preparing, of course, for the Paralympics in less than a week and a half. It follows again the Olympics, and she gets an email saying they want to feature you. Sports Illustrated, SI, wants to feature you in her bathing suit issue. Whoa. She's like freaking out. Are you kidding me? She probably melted the snow all around her because she got so excited. This is unbelievable, right? 22 years of age. She's an attractive woman, but that's beside the point. The fact is that she's below the knee amputee. She's an accomplished athlete who can or cannot maybe make the podium, can or cannot possibly make the qualifiers at the Paralympics. Same guidelines apply to athletes in the Paralympics. But the fact is that Sports Illustrated, a major player in the magazine world, in the print world, is looking at inclusivity in a different light. Just like last week when I mentioned the Gerber baby. Gerber, I think in 2015, started having a baby per year. Not them physically having a baby. The company doesn't have a baby. They feature a baby as a spokesbaby. Yes, that's what they call it. I know the baby doesn't speak. It's a spokesbaby. But this particular year, 2018, they chose Lucas, and I forget Lucas's last name, but a 1-year-old baby who's got Down syndrome. So the landscape is changing, and I love it. I just want to wrap my arms around the people, these decision makers, and just thank them. There's actually a lot of commercials during the Super Bowl and now during the Olympics about inclusivity, about there's a great line I thought of the other day, and I wanted to repeat it today on the air. It says, do what you can't. How powerful is that? Because we all say, just do what you can. I said to my son this morning when he was going to take a math test, do what you can. You're going to do great. but do what you can. I mean, we've grown up, right, with the, with that colloquialism. Do what you can. But spin it around. Turn it upside down. Do what you can, right? Doesn't that make sense? Absolutely. It's 20 minutes after the hour in New York City. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight. Thank you so much for joining me. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. So, you know, my son was like teetering on trying to learn a guitar. And I brought him for a lesson, and he's like, I don't know. I was like, well, what about the drums? He's like, yeah, I'll check out the drums. And that was about 8 months ago. And then 6 months ago, we stumbled upon an incredible facility in Asbury Park. And this was the fruition of what he's been doing for the last 6 months.
You guys ready to rock at 9 a.m. in the morning? I want to thank the crew here at the Stone Pony. You guys have been so welcoming and kind. Please welcome these guys. They rehearse every Sunday. There's a lot of smiling faces on this stage. Please welcome the band known as Galaxy Monsters.
Yeah, I think the Ting Tings have something to worry about. That's from the big gig. The Lake House Music Academy has a thing called the big gig after each semester where all the different age groups go to a legendary facility and gig. They do three songs, and that was my son's band, and he was on a kit. And I bring to the show John Liedersdorf. John Liedersdorf's got quite the bio. Drummer, songwriter, producer, entrepreneur, professor of rock and roll, role model, father, husband, and a guest on Insight. Welcome, my friend.
Hey, Mark.
Life has brought us back together.
Amen.
Yeah, man, this is awesome. So full disclosure, John and I went to high school together, and I have vague memories of you, but I remember you were a musician, you were a good guy, and I always enjoyed talking to you. And then 6-7 months ago, my wife's like, you know, we're looking into taking my son to some music lessons, and I'm shopping around, and she's like, oh, you got to check out this place in Asbury Park, which I talked about at the head of the show. What an incredible town Asbury Park is. It's been, this is the third gentrification and final because it's a major success. The town is revitalized and it's back. It's huge. It's a music mecca. It's a shopping mecca. It's a restaurant mecca. And so we check it out under the guise to my son, like, hey, let's just stop in here. Dad wants to check out this recording facility. And oh, yeah. They give music lessons too. My son comes in with me. And your music education director, Albie, took my son by the hand when the first 30 seconds with my permission said, hey, you want to get up there on a kit in that room where that band's playing? And he's like, yeah. And that's what you've made, my friend. Congratulations.
Thanks.
So you saw a niche. How did you discover something of this caliber that wasn't being fulfilled?
It's a bit accidental. I mean, I've, like you said, I've been always on the artistic side of it, and I was producing acts and working with artists, and some starting to have some major success. And one thing that I realized, because I was doing that 7 days a week, helping artists develop, I realized that—
For years.
And just realizing that there was a lack of support. And when I look back at my history, you know, I had the drive, I was excited— the passion, but man, I would have really benefited if I had some mentors, if I had someone who really understood what ultimately my goals were and were going to be there to support me in a large way. So when I was taking that role as a producer, co-writer, I realized that it makes a difference if you can say to somebody, you know, they might come in and want to be a singer. And then you can encourage them to be able to accompany themselves on a musical instrument. And then you can encourage them even further to start to make their own art and write their own music. And to be able to do that much, we needed a lot of help. We needed people there. So I had had my own recording studio then. And as that was getting too busy, I needed to open up a second one. And I just decided, you know, why don't I create some infrastructure in Asbury Park that will allow all these creatives to be in the same place. And it created a community. And that was really the vision. The Academy now, because of the, you know, we do have the recording studios and we have some of the biggest artists in the world come through to record. And, of course, the locals.
He says so humbly.
And, yeah. And the, you know, there's a scene there. There's, like you said, there's this there's amazing music store. It's the largest independent music store in
New
Jersey.
It's palpable, yeah.
There's
Russo Music.
Yeah, Russo Music. There is Bands on a Budget, which does merchandise for so many successful acts.
This is all in one building.
Yeah, we have a venue, a do-it-yourself venue there. And there, it's a music foundation where we raise money. Majority of the money is for Asbury Park kids that can't afford to take music, that don't get it, music education. We're going into the public schools.
And John, pardon my interruption, but that was integral for you to have that as part of the design for all of this, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is a community. I believe in community, and I see the power of it. And we've been able to bring so many children in, but we have programming now for 6 months old, and I have guys who've been retired for decades who are learning to play music. So
I met a 70-year-old the other day, and excuse my interruption here, but it's a great story. But I'm like, oh, my wife and I were talking. Oh, how long have you been coming here? Oh, a couple months, et cetera. So, how long has your son and daughter been, or what do they play? She's like, no, I'm here for me. I play the drums, and I travel an hour to come here. And I said, wow, that says it all.
Yeah, and it's neat. And there are all these different age groups and different types of curriculas that are supporting different age groups. Mm. But the neat thing is that how I learned how to play is by hanging out with my friends and saying, let's start a band. I didn't have any formal education.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Not at all. No, I mean, that's actually
12
very
years
powerful.
Of age, sure.
If you want to be a great snowboarder, then go out and snowboard.
That's right. So
right away, the model supported similar ways that my friends and I learned how to play, which you didn't have to necessarily study just the fundamentals. You didn't have to spend years learning your craft before you could play. You could play music day one. And I think that model has been very successful for so many people. And that's what happened. So like you said, Albie, with your son, hey, let's play today. Let's have fun today. And
that's a pivotal moment right there.
Yeah. Now, I really want everybody to learn how to read music and understand all the fundamentals as well. And that becomes a balance. So we, of course, we're supporting and we have music lessons at the same time. You can't just be in the band. You have to take the lessons as well.
And it's very structured.
Very structured. And the fun is structured. You come every week and it's been working. That model's been great. Now, the thing that I think is attracting so many of the people to the community is also they feel the relevance of it. So the Music Academy is basically connected to the recording studios. And we've had so many of these successful, well-known artists come out.
Lord.
Yep, and actually speak to the kids and give time to
Bon Jovi.
The kids. Yep.
And I read that they were blown away, the students, when a John Bon Jovi said, yeah, I still go into the city weekly for voice lessons.
Yes, absolutely.
They're like, what? Bon Jovi? Don't you have it down by now?
Right.
Hey, you have an instrument. You had to keep it tuned, man.
Absolutely. What a great time they had. And that was it was fabulous that he would give that way. He came in. He had a session in the recording studio. And I asked him, I said, would you ever consider talking to the kids? Absolutely. And when we followed up with him, he's like, yeah, I'll come. He came. Not only did he talk to the kids and share with him his journey and what he's doing, but he played for them, which was amazing. And then they played for John. They played a Bon Jovi song for him.
Even more amazing.
Yeah. And he was just wonderful. And so many of these artists do that for us. And,
yeah.
And because we're in Asbury Park and everybody comes to Asbury Park, there are a lot of people that do that. Now we have Monmouth University and their music industry program that has moved into the building. So there's a lot of education going on. There are a lot of possibilities, and we're creating more opportunities.
At the Boys and Girls Club, Asbury Park.
Yep, we have a partnership with them where we built this small hip-hop recording studio, and we bring a producer in every week. We bring in educators that talk about everything from dance classes, and we get the kids to dance. And it's not just dancing. It's learning the art of dance, and there are great instructors. But there's also we have a record 101 class where we're teaching them how to have their own businesses.
Engineering.
And then there's an audio engineering component. So we have a great managers there, and we bring producers to that every week. There's a big producer that comes and talks to the kids, and they're making their own music, they're making their own art, and they're learning how to promote it. So,
and as Gloria says, Asbury Park is, it's a seaside town, but I imagine 2/3 of it are inner city kids that don't have the means to have access to music until Lake House Academy appeared.
Well, that's nice.
Whether
to
they
say.
Choose to use it
yeah.
or not,
yeah, yeah, no. The school district has been amazing. They have created opportunities for us to connect with the kids, allow us to bring different curriculas in, collaborate. We listen to what their needs are. We now have a Lake House Recording Studios mobile bus.
Really?
Yes, and it has 10 workstations on it. All digital workstations.
Fantastic.
But there's a booth on the back, and they can play real instruments, or they can learn how to program them. Now, this bus is mobile, and it's just about to roll, and that is going to allow us to go into communities everywhere. So this is extending our reach. We can bring a specific curriculum.
That's incredible.
If you want to learn about simple audio engineering, and the neat thing about audio engineering is it immediately gives children this opportunity to learn computer literacy as well.
Oh, absolutely, sure.
You're learning the keystrokes. You're learning the value and the power in this little computer that's in front of you. And you can make great music.
And possibly down the road, this mobile Lake House truck vehicle can park outside the Stone Pony or any other incredible, iconic venue in Asbury Park and do a live show to tape for a live album.
Absolutely.
Down the road.
Absolutely. We're not using tape on the bus.
Well, yeah, exactly. We're old enough. We say tape. Just because I know you as an engineer, I mean, one of the principles behind developing and making a studio after moving from your Victorian house, which was incredible, the studio that you had downstairs. In 2013, I believe you moved to Asbury Park for the Lake House development. And one of the things you said to yourself is, we have to do it right. And you had a 1972 Neve console?
Yes. We have an 80s series console in one of the recording studios.
Didn't I see some reel-to-reels in there as well?
We do. We
see?
Actually do record to tape in the recording studios.
It has
we
a different
do.
Sound.
Yeah. And of course, digitally as well.
Of course.
Different artists and different art forms, the genres, they require different sounds. And it's amazing now the awareness of what happens when you record an ensemble, a group, a singer, but people together performing live. Mm. There's nothing like it. And we see that in our young students. Our 10, 11, 12-year-olds want to learn music from the 90s back. They're not as interested in the new music. And I'm sure some of that has to do with them playing real instruments. But it's true that what's resonated and what's sold and what's captured most of our attention is really something that's that honest, that's that real.
Mm, and that pure.
That pure, absolutely.
And the reality is, you know, how many of these students in a given 5 years are going to go on to be professional musicians? But it instills confidence. They have fun. They learn about creativity. And they can also learn that music will always be there for them.
Right.
Whether it's an instrument or something they can go to during a period where they need a good friend.
Absolutely. Every day someone's sending you something about the impact that music has on the brain development and goes down the line of the value in doing it. The other thing that people aren't realizing is that, you know, there are hundreds of people now that are employed right in our little community there, and they make good money, you know? So it used to be the backup plan is what I always hear. You know, what's plan B? We need a backup plan for my kid.
I'm 40 years old. You know, I can't be on the road anymore. What am I going to do?
Well, I'd hear that from the parents when the kids would come in.
Ah.
And they would say, well, they need a backup plan. All they care about is music. Well, you know, I immediately would shake. I would sit in my, you know, bite my tongue. But there's so much opportunity. And that's the one thing that people are realizing more and more is, can I be passionate about something? Can I be driven? Hmm. The skill sets that will come from working hard, that is where success will come.
And that's why you brought in these supremely talented music educators. I mentioned Albie's name before. I mean, did you meet him actually in the recording studio of your former location?
I've known him, you know, when we were, I hate to say it, late in our late teens we met. And he doesn't like to admit that he's as old as I am. But in my late teens, we used to play around the venues down at the shore together.
And you both toured internationally, different bands.
Yep, and he did have a record deal, and I was fortunate enough to be involved with him and produce some music for him. And that is where we connected strongly and deeply. And, you know, the vision of what was necessary and what was needed and what was lacking about having a place to get the education. You know, the one thing that we haven't talked about much is that we still are very much involved in bridging that gap from taking music lessons to understanding what it takes to have success as an artist. So we have a record label that we have an artist program, and so many of our educators have record deals or publishing deals, and we'll work with the kids.
Hmm. And when they're not at Lake House Academy, they're out gigging.
Yeah, so the kids
walk the walk.
Yeah, they get that relevance. Mm-hmm. The kids know, you know, if you're a teenager, you know if that person is still musically trying to be relevant or not.
I mean, the resume of the people at the helm of Lake House is impressive.
Yeah, we've hired some very very good educators that were
seasoned pros.
Yeah, and have the degrees and the letters after their names.
And the heart. That's everything. So when I walk around there, it's just not, you know, some grown-ups passing a bunch of kids. It's, hey, how's it going? I saw that piece or I heard what you did. It was amazing. And then they light up.
Right.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can't teach that. That's instilled in these people, and that's why they're at the Lake House.
Right.
Doing what they love.
And immediately, you know, you don't come in from an audition. You don't come in from, you come in because you want to make music, and there's a place. You know, we have so many educators and so many programs. And like you said, with the adult program, we have, I think we had almost 30 bands play at the Stone Pony at that big gig weekend.
That's amazing.
We had our babies. We have our director of elementary program, her name is Kimberly Grigoli, and she was a public school teacher. She had worked with children in music and helped to write a curricula with our director of education, Eric Novot. And she has programming for different age groups as young as 6 months old, the parent and me type of approach, but also at 3.5 to 5, at different levels where the kids are picking up the instruments, understanding rhythms, understanding pitch. Hmm.
And there's been a lot of research done on it.
Yes, yeah. and it's very powerful.
There's a book, I'm not sure if you read it, called Your Brain on Music.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great book, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to go back to probably when you were in high school, maybe even a little younger. Did you hang out at the Upstage in Asbury Park where Bruce used to hang out? And that was the environment that you have fostered in a much more educational, convivial way, but that's where people got their feedback and comfort, support.
Yeah, we are both a little too young to have.
It was gone by then.
It was gone by then. Right. Yeah, but interestingly enough, we were approached by someone who's making a documentary, and it's done now, about the Upstage. And I really had an opportunity to, you know, meet the players and listen to them talk about those times. They all came through our recording studio when the documentary was being made, and they talked about that great time. And there was a gentleman who ran a club called the Upstage, and it was
a husband and wife duo, I think, right?
Yep, it was alcohol free. There was no alcohol there, and generally the real musicians, after they would play around town, they would go to the jam, and the place would fill up. And it was a very late night, but there was a curator, and there was a gentleman there named Tom Potter. And
that was pretty advanced for back then.
Very
curator.
Absolutely. he would put people together. He would put different, there were two stages, and he would put different players together. And of course, you know, the legendary stories about the Upstage were Bruce and Southside Johnny, and then all the members from David Sanchez to Little Steven. They all talk about how that was really where they learned how to jam, how to play. That was their rock and roll education.
Instrumental.
Yeah. They learned that. They learned how to collaborate and make some decisions about what they were doing. And that story is, that type of story is connected to so many of these music scenes. You know, I go every year to South by Southwest, down in Austin, Texas, for the biggest music convention.
Phenomenal, yeah.
And you hear these stories, Smokey Robinson telling the story about, people always say to him, oh, there must be something in the water in Detroit. That's a terrible line right now to say. But the talent that was there, he directly, and the success of Motown, you know, he gave it up to Gordy Berry. He said, no, it's not. It's about people who care, people who create these opportunities.
And hard work.
It's a lot of work, but it has to be who you are, and you have to do it. And if you look at all these other scenes around, you know, when Dave Grohl was going around and exposing these recording studios and music scenes, there were always pockets of people who cared and created opportunities for artists, and that makes the difference. And that's why, you know, we have a music foundation.
And speaking of differences, I mean, there's a student who went from the stage of Lake House Music Academy to the Broadway stage.
Yeah. There's been a few of them, actually.
A few?
Yeah, and there are more coming.
So they got their money's worth. Yeah. So their parents don't need a plan B.
Exactly. But you do need that education.
Sure.
And you see that with a lot of successful artists is that they wish that they had spent more time studying music, playing that piano, understanding so many different aspects of the music business. We have guys who have, you know, are rock stars that come now and study there. You know, it's not just about kids. It's about a community. It's about...
You have Rob from Metallica.
Yeah.
Hasn't he been there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Has he spoken to the kids as well?
He played for the kids.
He played for the kids.
And, of course, they played a Metallica song for him. So,
Enter Sandman? In my mind, it's got to be Enter Sandman.
I think you're right. I'm not even kidding. I think that was the song.
My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on a Progressive Radio Network. John Ludersdorff is my guest. He's the owner of Lake House Academy, a really flourishing, incredible music mecca in Asbury Park. He's here talking about all the different music programs. Let's move on to a portion of the conversation I want to have about you, John. Playing the drums at age 12. And when the scene on the Jersey Shore, the music scene, was kind of in its heyday, it's kind of dwindling a little bit. About you had a band called Outcry, by the way, I love that name, that was just on a hot streak, man. So for then, in those days and those times, you must have been just living high on the hog and thinking, "Wow, this is it. It's paid off, and the sky's the limit." Tell me about those days.
Yeah, so the Outcry was interesting because Jason, who was the lead singer and definitely the main songwriter, he and I grew up together.
Freehold, New Jersey.
In Freehold, New Jersey.
20 miles east of Asbury Park.
Yes.
Home of Bruce Springsteen.
Yes. He went to the same schools that we went to. And it was kind of our family, our clique, our group. We started a band right away, and that's how we both learned how to play, is by hanging out and learning songs together. And having that focus thing, this band that became our identity. And that's where you know, that's really how it started. Then the band just, that was going to be what we, you know, we were going to have success as a band. And we did. I mean, relative success, but we did very well at the Shore.
Played at the Stone Pony a lot.
We would play every week. We had residencies at the Stone Pony. We had residencies at the Fast Lane. We had residencies in Long Branch at Cheers.
Cheers,
and Cafe,
wow.
Cafe Bar. We played Bar A. We played every...
Tradewinds.
We played the Tradewinds. We had a residency there for a while. We would go all over and even outside of the Shore area. And that's how we were making our living. And it was challenging. And we were playing our own music. So it was a little different than going out and playing the covers. So
how did you feel back then? Did you feel like you were exercising everything that you possessed? Or did you feel that your creativity was not totally being tapped into?
Individually or the band?
You.
Oh, no, yeah. I mean, the band did get a record deal. And we...
The Polygram?
Yeah, we charted at rock radio I think we hit number 30 for a minute. And
what song was that?
The song was called On and On.
That's right, On and On.
And no one knew who the hell we were, you know, outside.
But your fan base, you had a tremendous fan base on the Jersey Shore.
Yeah, we had people that would come out. And, you know, we learned a lot from that. But as some of the guys started to get older and get married, it was kind of a wake up call for me. It made me realize, holy shit, they're moving on, they're evolving, and I'm not done. I have a lot more that I want to do. And at that point, I started to educate myself on songwriting. I kind of took the limitations off that I felt I put on myself I had a role in the band, right? I had a role. I was the drummer, and I was the guy who was hustling around, getting the gigs. And that was my role, and that's what worked. But when I realized that was a limitation, it just exploded.
Yeah, just ask Dave Grohl.
Yes, and so many drummers. Mm. You know, there were so many drummers that
Big
did
time.
That. And I realized that... I had a lot of work to do, and I was excited about doing it. And then
segue into Blow Up.
Yes.
The next band.
Yes. And
which did blow up.
Yeah. I went from being, you know, behind the band to fronting a band, singing, writing the songs, and
opening for R.E.M.
Yeah. We had a lot of great shows.
Blues Traveler.
Yeah. There were bands at that time, like bands like Fuel.
Great bands, man. All those bands. I can't remember. I loved them.
Yeah, there were a few. I can't remember all the names. They had those hits at those early 2000s.
Yeah, exactly. There was a woman who I read in your bio that you opened for, not Sean Colvin, someone like her. And I was like, wow, she was amazing.
Yeah.
But I remember reading, whether it was in the UK, that you had something like 20 gigs in 10 days or something.
Yeah. We were touring. We were having fun.
And you were opening for the Spin Doctors at Lehigh University, and they were late. And you ended up playing for 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But now that's rock and roll. Isn't that a great story?
Yeah, they were fun. It was fun times. Being in band and putting all of your time into being an artist creates a lot of opportunities
for
you.
Yeah. So, John, where do you shine most? Is it behind the kit, pen in hand, behind engineering, producing? Singing?
I think
we're educating now.
You know, I'm a parent now. You know, I have a couple of kids, and I think the place to shine is to serve. And there have been a lot of opportunities where we are able to serve, and I'm able to serve, and that's really the highest way to live for me right now. And I know it sounds corny, but it's real. And there's
a part two to this answer. I feel it coming.
and I think if there's anything that I'm supposed to be doing that right now and feels right is when I am supporting others.
And it's exactly what you're doing. And going back to Lake House Academy, when you realize that you're outgrowing your Victorian house, and your wife probably said to you, listen, it's either you or the gear that's got to go. So then you said, all right, I'll take the gear to another place. When you envisioned another venue, Did it have all these bells and whistles, or were you thinking about, number one, just a space that'll house a facility that, you know, that I see in Mix Magazine, or that I, you know, all the studio sessions I played at in the city as a session drummer. What is it, FM station? What's the other place in Midtown at, like, where Hendrix used to play at? What's it called?
Electric Lady.
Electric Lady. I mean, you've been to those studios, I'm sure, dozens and dozens of times. Were you thinking about that? And then that's when you said, oh, wow, I am civic-minded. I grew up here. These are my roots. This town is going through a major transformation. This is how I'm going to couple everything.
Hmm. Yeah, I, you know, I'm not a hyper-cerebral guy. I
beg to differ.
The vision for me usually comes from feeling and seeing what's in front of me. And when I was working with so many artists, realizing, and I could myself, what would have been helpful to me? What would have made... help me as a child, as a teenager, as a, you know, a young artist, and realizing that that was missing, that there wasn't really a community that was nurturing that. I realized what that could look like, and then I just said, you know what, I want to do it really well. I want to do it with quality. I want to do it with heart, and I want it to serve. I want to help create this community. And, you know, music for me was always my family. When I was 5 years old, my mother's boyfriend had a band in the basement. And that was, music was just the thing, always.
The way of life.
Yeah, and like I said with Jason, we weren't a band, we were a family. We, you know, we both had rough lives. And music is where we were.
Escapism.
It's where we could get straight.
Even for adults, even if you don't have a tough life, you have a tough day at work.
Yeah,
you know, how many people were walking around New York City when you walked up to the radio station here and, you know, everyone's tuning out the world. They got their buds in.
Yes.
Listening to the Progressive Radio Network or their favorite Metallica song or, you know, a podcast of this show. No. But it's just amazing how camaraderie exists, you know, in music and how especially this is going off on a sidebar here. I saw a documentary the other day on Showtime or HBO. Avid Brothers,
mm-hmm.
I mean, phenomenal. And I'm not a huge fan of folk music, but that just, to me, encompasses how much music is just relative and bonding and uniting. Because at the end of this hour, I'm looking up, I bought their music, right? I've never done that before watching a documentary. That's how awe-inspired I was about their role as like just brothers, and then their relationship with music and how organic it comes to them, and just how they feel and how they've accepted their fame by being just really humble.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing to me. And I'm familiar with the music. I'm not familiar with the documentary, but I'm watching it.
Must watch. So, John, what is it when you were performing, is there something that you've captured that for the kids when they walk into these spaces? For example, my son, he takes a 2-hour band class every week, once a week, pardon me, where he has music instruction, theory, et cetera, and then they get to jam three songs, and the crescendo of this semester, they'll play a gig. And that's great. And then they have a 30-minute session where it's one-on-one. But the environment itself is music, whether it's rock and roll, whether it's classical music, whatever, the violins being tuned down the hallway. But when you are on stage as a singer, as a drummer, or behind a console, you know, you have all these experiences that, you know, that it's a higher form of than language can actually describe, but it seems palpable there. And is there any one thing that when you walk off a stage or when you dreamed of making something of this, when this facility was in your non-cerebral mind that you said it must have?
Yeah, relevance. It needs to be relevant. That was important to me.
One of your mantras.
Yeah. It needs to be real. It needs to be honest. I think this type of experience that you're talking about when you're listening to music or you're performing or any kind of connection to it, it's faster than thinking. You're feeling music. You're experiencing music. And that part that's in everybody, you know, there's a BS meter there too, right? You can't fake it. And when you see some of these programs and some of these situations, mm-hmm. and you can tell that your teacher doesn't want to teach you, and the kid knows that, the student knows that. So I think just that the honesty is important. And from there, you start to ask the bigger questions. If we're all really looking at this, and the student and the teacher, and they're in the room, like, what's here and how are we going to make this fun? How are we going to make this real?
And I think you've executed that well. And the reason why, you know, I have you on the show here today, this isn't a commercial for what you've built. This is about the impact it has on the people who walk through the door. And whether it's in a music facility, a bowling alley, or in school, it's about enriching the lives of the youth and for adults as well. But, you know, for the most part, for aspiring musicians. And I think that's just, you know, you can't put a price tag on that.
Yeah. And I think that's something that that I feel is correct right now, is that why don't we try to live that way? Why don't we be in service? Why don't we do something that's real and that we're passionate about?
And when a kid is 30 years old or 40 years old, driving with his girlfriend or boyfriend or both down the road in Asbury Park, and they look to the left and say, oh, the guy or girl is in the car going, oh, yeah, Stone Pony. Yeah, I played there when I was 8 years old. Woody, are you kidding me? Yep, it's called the Big Gig.
Right.
And here's a ticket of the Big Gig if you're looking on Facebook Live. It's phenomenal. It's just one of the many ways and components that make that day special. It's 3 days of music, from start early in the morning, 9 o'clock in the morning, like we heard Albie saying, hey, it's 9 o'clock in the morning. You're ready for rock and roll. So I guess when they start kicking you out before the paying bands come in at nighttime at Stone Pony. But it's remarkable to have an individual, you know, you played on a stage of the Stone Pony with Brian Setzer when WNEW was having their beach concerts. And by the way, I think I engineered, we could have been right across the street from each other. And also, was that when when did you jam with Bruce? That was with another venue, correct?
We would play every Sunday at Cheers in Long Branch.
That's right, with a gentleman named Brian. Who was that? Yeah,
Oh, that band was Outcry. Outcry.
We played, was it Outcry?
Yeah, we played there every Sunday. And yeah, you know, everybody knew at some point Bruce was going to come play with us. And one night we would do three sets, and the majority of it was our own music. And we were playing our first set. It was early, and people were just rolling in. And there he comes. The boss walks in the room, and you feel it when he walks in the room.
The guy you were watching, Phil Giant Stadium,
yes,
walked into your room.
Yeah, he walked in while we were playing. And We get off the stage, yeah, and his people, you know, come up, and he goes, hey, guys, really great stuff, man. And we looked at him, and yeah, we'll play. He goes, what do you know? And we didn't have any set list. We said, well, what do you want to play? He goes, I'll just start calling off songs. And he literally called off 8 songs that lasted for probably an hour and a half. By the time we went back out on the stage, the doors were locked because the place was packed. There was a phone booth. This was obviously, you know, when not everybody had a cell phone, and the place was packed. And when I tell you that the guy lives to entertain, he was the most phenomenal entertainer. And everybody in the room was standing on the bar, laying on the floor. You did whatever he told you to do. He controlled the band. He's the best band leader. And it was one of those experiences that was remarkable.
Iconic night.
Iconic.
In an iconic city with an iconic new facility, Lake House Music Academy. John Liederstor, founder, musician, drummer, songwriter, role model, giver backer, taking Asbury Park to another level. So we're going out with a song that we heard from the band we heard already before, Galaxy Monsters. These boots were made for walking. John, thanks so much for your time. Continued success. It's LakeHouseMusicAcademy.com. My name is Mark Farrell. Gary Knowles next.